Today we're going to start session 4, class 7, in Sefer HaChinuch. We're on page 369 of volume 1. So we want to finish up this mitzvah, 95, to build the Holy Temple. Yeah, we are almost at the end of that mitzvah. It's pretty exciting. I know, it's a long mitzvah. That's a good one to spend time in. So among the aspects of this mitzvah is that once we build the temple in Jerusalem, we can't offer up any offerings in other places. It becomes centralized and became permanently centralized. So it's interesting because we used to be able to offer up animal offerings in any place that we would build a proper altar, and there were halachas for that. Well, once the temple was built, it was all centralized in the temple and never was diffused again. However, that being said, of course, our prayers today are those offerings. They're not animal offerings, but are in place of those, and now it's diffused again. We can pray anywhere, pray congregationally anywhere, pretty much, almost anywhere. So that, again, is spread throughout. Somebody's phone is hungry.
Hungry, yeah, that's
about
to die.
Right. Right. No, that's a feed me. Right, so from the time the temple was built, all other places became banned to build a temple and offer up sacrifices there. For it is stated, this is my resting place forever in Psalms, but it's referring to that spot. Okay, so now let's just look at the construction of the temple, but this is why I brought a picture, and we're going to go more into this in coming weeks, but just a start. We're just going to look at four places. So a holy chamber and a holy of holies are to be made in it. Before the holy chamber, there should be a curtain, a certain place called the ulam. And all three together are called the Heichal. So Heichal refers to, it means palace, refers to the temple, and that's the temple inside the temple.
So on the picture, can you show us?
Yes.
What that looks like?
So, and I know I brought myself an extra picture. I did. Right. So the Heichal is that middle building inside the main Azara. Okay, so here's our picture right here. And this whole structure right here is called the Heichal.
And it's labeled.
This one right? It's labeled.
The whole thing. So it looks like it's labeled. It's labeled in the middle.
Right.
But the way I labeled it was just by making a bracket around the whole building, because all those things together are called Heichal. So you have the Kadosh Kadoshim, and then you have this part in front, which is the Kadosh.
This is the Kadosh.
Yeah. And then the Ulam in front, and the whole structure is called the Heichal.
Okay.
So that's the Heichal. Right, the whole building is the Beit HaMikdash.
Right.
But, and then these parts are, I'm pretty sure, are generally called the Azara. Hello. Good morning. Even though there's different areas of Azara. So we have the, it's called Azara by itself. And
the outer part.
Yeah, so the space, this main space, gathering space, is Azara. And we even have an Azara here in front near the Mizbeach is an Azara. So I'm saying Azara, but just in case you don't know this grammatical structure, I'll show you this, so good for you to know. There is a grammatical structure called Smichut, where you connect one word to another. When you connect that one word to another and it becomes belonging to that other word, then you change the He at the end of the word to a Taf. So Azara is the general area. But if you make it specific, it's Ezrat Nashim, Ezrat Kohanim. Those are the specific. So when you have that Ezrat formulation, and you have the Smichut, you could say Azara Shel Nashim, Azara Shel Kohanim. Yeah, it's a contraction. Yeah, it's a specific contraction, right? So if there's a hey at the end of the word that you're adding on to the next one, then it turns into a taf. There's other ways of doing it, like, for instance, a beit Knesset is smichut also. It's really a bite shell Knesset. But in that case, it already has a taf at the end, so you're switching it to beit from bite, and that makes it smichut. So now it's a specific house of assembly, is what a beit Knesset is. So we usually translate it idiomatically as synagogue, but really it's a house of assembly. So, Beit Knesset, Beit Sefer, Beit Shel Sefer, a school, right? A house of books,
and
which
the,
is school, not
Nashim
a library.
Is translated as people.
Nashim is women.
Women. Well, that's
women.
Right.
That's correct. However, you are right in that the Ezrat Nashim is where all the people are.
Yeah, so
not
that's
just
like
the women.
So
not
but
just
it's named for us, so we got to mix with the men then.
Absolutely, in this area it was mixed. Yes. Now, because of the mixing and that being problematic, a balcony was built, actually, specifically for Simchas Beit HaShoeva, Simchat Beit HaShoeva, the Simcha Shel Beit HaShoeva, right? That's also Simchat Beit HaShoeva. So during that time, with all the singing and dancing that was going on in the Beit HaMikdash, it was such a joyous time that it hopefully wasn't frivolous, but was certainly highly energetic. And unlike Aish, where there was full contact hakafos here, they had, you know,
the tossing in there.
Yeah, they had the tossing and the, I don't know, it was like football hakafos here. But it was certainly highly energetic and lots of contact, physical contact between people. So they built balconies for the women to be separate during that time. And it's actually from Simchat Beit HaShoeva that we learn about separation and dancing and possibly even in davening. Yes, yeah, so that's a curtain there.
And then that's the Holy of Holies right
there. Right, inside, right.
Okay, and are these like the showbreds, kind of the...
Yeah, so we're going to go more into all those little pieces a different time.
Okay.
But...
Pardon?
Yeah. No, there's lots of stuff to learn here. So today's focus is on the reverence and awe of the sanctuary altogether.
Not the details of it.
So we wanted these four main places, because that's what it says in our mitzvah here. And I'm definitely using the book to keep us focused.
And then four is the Azara.
Let's see. We have the Holy Chamber, the Holy of Holies, which is the and the Ulam, so that's three. That's all called the Heichal.
Right.
And then the Azara is the fourth area, and all that together makes the Mikdash.
So is this the Ulam right here?
This front porch area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is
the Ulam.
This area.
Mm-hmm.
Here.
That's the Ulam.
What's Ulam?
Ulam is a hall. And today it's used as hall. Like there's an Ulam. You make a wedding in an Ulam.
Mm-hmm.
A hall. So it's not a hall like a hallway, a prose door. It's a hall like a wedding hall, that type of a hall. You know, not the skinny kind, the big kind. Yeah, a room type.
Just for understanding, this is the altar, the Mizbeach, where they did the sacrifices?
Correct. Okay. That is the Mizbeach. And then we have a Mizbeach Zahav somewhere. We have the menorah there. We have a bunch of things there. And the kior. So we'll look at that at a different time. Okay, so we have those. So is that clear? We have the Heichal, which has three parts to it. The Kadosh Kadoshim, and the Ulam. All that together is called the Heichal. And the Heichal is then flowing from in front of the Heichal out to the edges is the Azara area, which has specific areas. But we're just, the one main thing is the Azara. So that whole thing together, and it's really concentric circles if you think about it. The Mikdash has concentric circles. So first comes the Azara. Then comes the Heichal. Then the Ulam actually doesn't surround it, but then the Ulam is the next step up, then the Kadosh, and then the Kadosh Kadoshim. All right, so it's all gets holier and holier each step up. Okay, so the whole thing together is called the Mikdash, which the root of that word is Kadosh, holy.
Excuse me, I'm sorry for interrupting.
No problem. Guys. Then the objects and utensils written in the Torah that are needed there would be made for use in the sanctuary. And then, so here's an additional law. So now it's just giving you the where are you going to find additional information, right? So and what will that additional information be? But here's just one point that he's showing you also that included in the additional information is everything that's made inside the Beit HaMikdash, all the utensils and all that stuff. But if one of them chips or breaks, or a knife separates from its handle and becomes nicked, then that has to be taken away right away. It has to be remelted and remade because you're not even going to repair it. It has to be hidden at once because you can't have poverty in a place of wealth. So it reminds me kind of my mother's history, and what's her name? Dolly Parton has that song, Coat of Many Colors,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is about all the patches. She felt loved with all those patches.
Right.
And my mother used to say that she loved to see patched things because it showed that somebody cared enough about the garment to fix it, to patch it, to add to it, to invest in it, to repair it, Right, but for other people, they had another point of view. That shows you're too poor to buy a new one. You have to patch that.
And that's what this sort
right?
of is.
So that's what this is saying, is that patching is a sign of poverty. And this is a place of wealth. This is a place of perfection. So we don't use fixed things here. We'll take that knife, we'll melt it down, we'll make a fresh one, but we're not fixing it. This is a place of perfection.
Well, also, doesn't that hinder the shaxing of the animal? Like, doesn't the blade have to be absolutely perfect?
Yes, it does. But let's just say that the blade slips from the handle, right? You know how
the
handles have
the
right? It doesn't hurt the blade at all. But it's an imperfect knife now. So that has to be hidden immediately because we can't have that in the Beit HaMikdash.
And today, they just fix it. Today they fix it to shack an animal.
Oh, yeah, and you can fix it.
Right.
No problem.
It's in the temple.
It's
right.
in the temple, right. And it is elitist. I mean, it's not that it's elitist. It's that. So it has to do with the other mitzvahs that we're about to learn today. It's about the reverence and the awe. We have to remember that what is the temple? It's certainly, it is a house of God. It's not a house of God. God doesn't need a house, right? We need to build that house of God. So it's all about us, and it's all about influencing us. So we do understand wealth and poverty. Right? And that makes an impression on us. So the impression that needs to be made on us is no blemishes here. That's why animals can't be offered with blemishes, and there's different levels of blemishes that are blemishes that disqualify. We have to draw all those lines. What qualifies, what disqualifies, where is the line where it's appropriate and inappropriate, and all of that is to make an impact on us. So this is one of those impacts. We don't have imperfection in that place of perfection. We don't have poverty in the place of wealth. So the rest of the details, including
since the flood, is it sort of understood that we cannot impact God? Since after the flood, God said he was never going to do us all in again.
Right. So what do you mean we can't? Before the flood, we couldn't impact God either. God is perfect and unchanging. And we can't add or
impact God every minute.
No, we don't. We do not.
He impacts us.
We don't impact God, but we do interact with God. We do not. No.
But we don't change
God.
Right.
We do not impact God. We do not impact God. We interact with God.
By doing
mitzvahs. Yeah, we interact, but we do not impact God. We do not add to God, and we do not take away from God. So we can eat all the treif we feel like eating, and it is not going to take away from God at all. And we can be as holy as we want to be, learn Torah all day long, never speak a word of Lashon Hara again in our lives. We will not add to God at all. We do not impact God. God is perfect and unchanging. What we do impact is creation, us and creation. God has created space for us to be co-creators. So we definitely impact creation. But creation is not God. God has created space to allow a give and take where we can engage with God and it's not exactly change his decisions because the decisions are already there. Meaning if we choose this, we're going to get this. If we choose that, we're going to get that. So we get to make the choice. So it's not that we change God, it's that God already set up that whatever we choose, we get.
So he just gave us the space to make the choice.
Right, mm-hmm. right. So if we...
If you don't tshuva, I'm going to do this. If you
right,
don't, I'll do it.
Right. So that's not changing God. Right, he's not changing his mind. So even though occasionally we do see places where, for instance, by the flood, God says he regretted creating the world. Did he really regret, though? Can he regret? That would be changing one's mind. That's what nichum is, linachem, is to change something. That's why when we comfort mourners, it's called nichum avelim. It's not really, that's the idiomatic translation, comforting mourners, but it's not. It's to change the mourning into not mourning, right? You are comforting them, but the comfort is meant to alleviate the mourning. It's nichum, to change it. Just like, it uses the word nichum also by in the book of Jonah, where Jonah is upset with God that he's nichum al hara, that he changed his mind about he forgave the bad that they were doing and he didn't destroy them. Right? So that's one of his accusatory words, is you're nichum al hara. But does God change his mind? Not really. It's all set up.
Governing can change decrees. And
that's not changing God's mind.
It's changing his decision.
No.
That's what she's saying.
It's not.
She's saying
you can't impact God.
You can't change God's mind. You can change who you are. So God can send out an energy flow whose destination is you as you are now. So let's say there's a negative decree headed in your direction, God forbid, right? Mm-hmm. You can change who you are, and then the address for that negative decree no longer exists. And so that negative decree won't come to you. But you didn't change God's mind. You changed who you are so that that negative decree no longer applies to you.
I wouldn't say changing his mind. I would say influencing.
Right. So what it is a little bit
not.
Right. It's a little bit semantics, but it's not. You have to understand there is a difference between changing God and changing the way things work.
So interesting. I had an experience last week. I was supposed to drive someplace near the airport, and something inside of me said, "Don't go." I just felt I was going to have an accident, and I get out of the car. I go outside, and there's a friend of mine who had an accident right on my corner. So God changed the address. The accident mm-hmm. never happened, but to whom?
Hmm. Right, so, and it has to do with really you. How will you be impacted? So whether the accident had to happen or not, and to whom, is a different question. But
well, I don't consider that changing God.
No, it's not changing God. And it's not changing God if you daven that something shouldn't happen to you and it doesn't. That's not changing God either. You know, if somebody goes for a mammogram and
God,
right?
But you're doing
you are engaging
God.
With the so energies of the universe in a way that God allows you to engage with them.
If that's the case, then when you daven, for example, for someone's health.
Mm-hmm. Not your own.
Yeah, not your own.
Correct.
But you're davening for someone mm-hmm. else's health. You're asking for God to... I mean, what are you asking for?
Let's make it like this. You're davening for food, right? And now you go plant a garden. And food grows from that garden, which you can share with anybody. That's like davening for somebody else's health. You can daven because God gave you the ability to plant a seed and food will grow from it. He gave you the ability to plant a prayer and results will grow from it. So it's not that the only influence of a prayer is that it changes you. It's that prayers can work in different ways, like seeds can grow. Now you might have to change the soil. You might have to give some fertilizer. You might have to give more water or less water. You have to have the right environment for those seeds to grow, and good seeds too, and different seeds produce different things. So prayer is like that. Prayer can influence you and your internal self so that your address has changed. You become a different person.
Right.
That's that reflective.
Right.
You're praying, you're changing yourself through prayer. But also, we are co-creators. God created the world through language. 10 edicts. And he said, he specifically used language to create the world and then made us in his image. Part of the image he made us in is that we have language and our language can create. So not only does it create or the converse destroy friendships and relationships, in the world, but we have that mystical ability to use our language to create and the converse as well. So prayer is the way that we do that.
So maybe you could say that all these possibilities exist.
Yes.
And when we change what we're doing, we are tapping into different possibilities.
Yes. Excellent. So we have not changed God or impacted on God at all. We've just chosen the reality that we want. And all of them do exist for us.
All the choices in the world existed at creation, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So all the choices are there. We just get to pick.
Right.
Now, to make it extra, I mean, that's an excellent insight.
God knows what we're going to pick.
And just to make it extra confusing, God already knows what you're going to pick. But that doesn't mean you don't get to pick. And that is what it is. All those choices, sort of like, and we can understand it better today with computer games, right? Computer games don't respond to you. They're programmed so that no matter what choice
you
make, there's another course of action that it's going to take in response to what you did. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it keeps going depending on the decision that you make. But it's not that it's intelligent. It's not figuring out what to do next. It's been programmed for it. So the world is like that. It's been programmed for us. So that no matter what decision we make, the next door opens up according to that decision. And it's got the infinite possibilities after that.
It's like those books you used to read your kid, Choose Your Own Ending.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's what we get to do. That's exactly what we get to do. We do get to choose our own ending. And the more we know, the more of an educated choice we can make. It's like Sims, where educated consumers are best customer, right? So the more education we get, the better choice we can make about the end we want. Right? It's completely up to us.
I have a mind-boggling story.
Okay.
I don't want to hear it, though.
If you don't want to hear it, that's fine.
Can you make it short?
It's pretty short.
Okay, let's hear it.
My son, I went to see somebody, I can't really explain this, about a minor health problem outside of regular conventional medicine. He uses this machine that picks up energies. The energetic level of your cells, he says, if you can change the, I don't know how it works, the frequency, the energy that your cells are concentrating on, you can free up your body for healing your main problems, okay? And he uses this machine, like I said, you sit in this thing, and you have a pad in the back, and he waves this wand over this metal plate. You know who I'm talking about?
No, but something similar.
Uh-huh.
I know similar.
Been there, done that.
Anyway,
didn't work.
For you.
Didn't work.
Well, for you.
I've had a lot of success, so
yeah.
I love this guy. Anyway, I happened to mention my son dying. And he says, well, what was his name? And he starts, switches his attention from me to him. And he says,
to your dead son.
Yes. He says, he is not here. He said, I want you to know I talk to people all day long whose loved ones have passed. And he said, and their spirits are hanging around. They don't leave. He said, but your son, he is so busy. He's learning. He's studying. He's attending classes. He is so happy. Mm. On a scale of 1 to 10, he's a 65.
Mm. Wow.
Mm. That's great. He built his Olam Haba. He made choices, and
wow.
He is being rewarded.
Wow.
That is really good. That's the message it sends to me.
Wow.
That our choices
matter.
Will make a difference.
For sure. For sure. Wow. That's amazing.
He's in my name.
Wow.
He said, I can't even get him to come down now. We're talking about it. He said,
Wow. That is really something.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
That is so beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, it brings me comfort.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
The
That's
message
good.
It sends that what is awaiting us.
Right.
We choose.
Right. Is what we choose. That's the thing. So we have to choose well. Good. Okay. Thank you for that story. All right, so let's just finish this one up. How exciting is this? The rest of the details are in Talmud Tractates Menachot and Yoma. That's where it concentrates on the Beit HaMikdash. This mitzvah is enforced when the majority of Jews are settled in their homeland, which means that it's coming up. We don't have the majority of Jews yet in our homeland, but we're getting there. It's one of the precepts that are not imposed on any individual, but rather on the entire community. When the temple will be rebuilt soon in our days, a positive precept will be fulfilled. Okay, so that's that one. Next, we go to number 40. We looked at 40 and 41 earlier. So we're just going to look at them quickly because it is part of this kind of unit of awe and reverence. Really, we probably should look at it out of order, but we're not going to since I just put it. We really should look at 254 first, because that's the unit, really, of this class, is to have reverent awe for the sanctuary. Let's do that. Let's look at 254 first. Why not?
I didn't get the memo.
Oh,
right.
Oh, sorry. Right. That's okay.
You sorry.
We'll read you from the outside.
She told us it was
here,
really short.
I'll look at Sandy. She looked at that one.
That's a good idea.
Oh, I'll look at Rose.
Oh, all right.
Okay.
So I went to page 135.
Okay. So 254
on
page 135 in volume 3.
Since Rose doesn't have her glasses, I'll point to her.
The precept of reverent awe for the sanctuary. So the mitzvah here is to have reverent fear of the sanctuary. In other words, that we should regard and establish it in our souls as the place of awe and veneration, so that our hearts will be moved when we come there to pray or bring offerings. For it is stated, you shall reverence my sanctuary. So it's interesting because we What does that mean? It's not. This is not one of the constant mitzvahs.
Fear of the sanctuary.
Right? We have six constant mitzvahs, and this is not one of them, although initially the language just sounds like it might be, to have reverent awe.
Yeah,
that could be a constant mitzvah.
Right.
So you always feel a reverent awe for the sanctuary, mm-hmm. whether or not you're there, whether or not it exists, right? It sounds like it might be. But we'll see that the mitzvah is very specific in the physical behavior that it requires. So it's not one of the constant mitzvahs of the mind. But it is interesting to understand this, that we still have, in a way, when we get to the Kotel, which is the closest thing that we have to it today, we do have that reverent awe. And there is a way to behave there. So this mitzvah is manifest specifically physically. One should not enter the Temple Mount with his walking stick, with his shoes on, with his money bag or purse, with the dust of travel on his feet, or with his money gathered in his tunic. I'm not sure what that means, but I guess if you...
Leave your purse at home.
Well, so you can't leave your purse at home because you're buying sacrifices. For sure you're giving tzedakah to the ladies begging at the kotel, but that's outside the sanctuary. But the question is, when you're going to the sanctuary, you're bringing an offering usually. So, and that offering costs money. So how do you arrange all that? So now we can have a credit card. But
you can put it in your... That's not considered money.
I don't know. We'll have to figure that out.
When we allusion, to Christ's thing about the money lenders in the temple and, doing business, that type of thing.
Right. We, in general, don't say his name, but I think it's better to say Jesus than Christ, I'm just saying because Christ means is the anointed Messiah.
Right.
We certainly don't want to give him a title,
right?
No, it's not, because JC is short for Jesus Christ, meaning name and title.
Well, Jesus was the name that...
We say Yashka, that's the Jewish way to say it, but Jesus, you could say Jesus, right?
That was his name.
That was his name, right. So we are careful, names empower, so that's why we have a thing about calling people by their proper name. And not using a nickname, so that's why we don't want to necessarily say it. But it's better, I think, to say Jesus than it is to say Christ, because Christ is the title which we don't give him.
Okay.
Right. So,
but at any rate.
But in his story, there is recorded, incidents of the money changers, because there were money changers. Now, of course, the Jews are always bad in the New Testament, basically, or whatever you want to call the Christian books. But so the money changers are considered. Corrupt and negative, and how could you have money in the temple, right? So that's because they're looking at the system differently than us, in that the reality is you need to change money. People are coming from all over the world. They have different currencies. Money has to be spent to buy an offering, and so you will have to change the money that you come with into the money that can be spent for the activities of the location, right? So it's not that it's a base activity there. You have to have it. Right, there has to be that function. It's like cutting vegetables for Shabbos. Is that low? Is it beneath somebody? Well, you have to do that in order to prepare a Shabbos meal, in order to have the sanctity of the Shabbos table. You have to shop. So, in order to do what you have to do in the temple, you have to change money. That's just what it is.
You just don't need it out. You do your money changing here.
You don't bring it in with you.
I think the idea is right. There has to be an outside activity and inside activity.
So, but then what do you do? So you bring the exact amount of money you need to purchase the sacrifice.
Right, so it's a good question. What do you do with that? I don't know. Maybe there was a place to leave that stuff.
Like lockers.
Right.
I mean, maybe.
Right, was there a trust system? Was there a guard system? I don't know exactly how it was set up, but it's a good question. Right, I think there probably was something like that. And you certainly see it. Lahavdil, at Muslim places of worship where you leave shoes outside, there is a system for leaving and retrieving your shoes. Hundreds, maybe thousands of pairs, right? So you do see that. So I'm sure it was something similar to that, where there was a system for leaving what you couldn't bring in outside and being able to retrieve it later. You know, we're capable of coming up with something like that. If we could build the whole temple, I think we could figure out a way to store shoes, right? Right. Right. So you're not allowed to go in with that stuff. You should not use it for a shortcut. And this applies to synagogues today, even to sanctuaries today. You know, let's say you were in the women's section of Aish and you needed to get to the kitchen. You should not walk through the men's section to get into the kitchen area. You should exit the door and go around. You're not supposed to use a sanctuary as a shortcut.
But
No, I was talking about here. But let's say in there, Abraham. Let's say, I don't know, you live near the back door, right? And the back door is open.
You need to get to the kitchen.
Right.
They close the divider.
Right. Well, then you have to go around. But I'm saying, let's say you live near the back
go
door.
Around what?
let's say you live in Naomi Erlanger's house, right? And there's a door, the back door of the shul, where you could walk in that back door, cut through the sanctuary, and get to the kitchen. You're not allowed to do that. You have just to get to the kitchen. You have to go around to the front of the shul, walk through the social hall to get to the kitchen, because you can't use a sanctuary as a shortcut. So that's part of the reverence and awe for a sanctuary. Even if it's empty, you're not allowed to use a sanctuary as a shortcut. So, right, so that's what it says here, merely to shorten the route. So that's a shortcut. And by Kal Vachomer, certainly if you can't use it as a shortcut, you're not allowed to spit there. Right?
Yeah. It has to be closed if you're in there, even if you walk through the front door. Mm-hmm. You cannot go to the kitchen in ZA because
right.
that divider is open. And it's always open.
Right. So that, but the idea is, no matter what the shul is, you can't walk through. No shortcuts in shuls.
People do.
Right. But they shouldn't. Now you all know. Right. The more educated you can become, the better choices you can make. Right. You can show reverence and awe, and by that fulfill this mitzvah by not taking a shortcut through a sanctuary. So you could even have in mind, I'm fulfilling the mitzvah of reverent awe for the sanctuary. I don't have the sanctuary to show it to, but I will use this sanctuary to be like that and fulfill this mitzvah of reverent awe. So the root reason, and that's why we started with this one for this section, is the root reason is what he wrote about above in this long mitzvah that we just finished, and let them make me a sanctuary. It's that we need to invest in a physical place in order to transform ourselves spiritually. And so there are different ways to invest in that. But that's what he's saying in 95 is so long that we just have to summarize it that way by saying it's our job as human beings to take that mitzvah, which is a physical, remember, mitzvah is a physical pathway to a spiritual goal. So the mitzvah, the physical pathway to the spiritual goal of 95 is build a sanctuary to accomplish a state of you've created space inside yourself for God.
I'm surprised it doesn't talk about not speaking and socializing.
This is not about during services. This is about
the place
itself.
The place, but even in the place itself here, you're not supposed to.
Right, you're not supposed to have.
Engage
no, you're not. That's correct. Right, you're not allowed to do that. Yeah, you're not supposed to have a conversation. It's interesting. I'm learning the Rambam with somebody, and so the Rambam says, actually, that a study hall is more sanctified than a place of prayer. And in a study hall, you are not allowed to have any conversation at all whatsoever.
Except about the
material that you're studying. Mm-hmm. But I remember also learning that in a synagogue, you're not allowed to have idle chatter, I'm trying to remember if you're allowed to learn. Like, you must be allowed to learn. But you're not allowed to have any kind of idle conversation at all in either place. You're supposed
at
to step
time.
Out. No, not at any time. So if you're going to have a conversation, you should step out of the sanctuary.
I think that's a lesson probably a lot of people could
benefit
from.
For sure during davening, but even after, like when somebody comes over, the services are over,
and you're
waiting to exit, so you shouldn't just be chatting, right? You should, somebody comes over and says, good Shabbos, say hi, good Shabbos, and let's go out. And just try to get out as quickly as possible so you can have your conversation in the social hall or in the hallway. But it's not appropriate to be chatting in the sanctuary.
Well, Rabbi Meyer set the precedent from the beginning.
That's during services. I'm not talking about services. I'm talking about an empty sanctuary. After. People do chat. Right? People do chat as they're exiting. They exit slowly and chat. You should go out quickly, you should just,
People let their kids go in there and play.
Right. So it doesn't happen so easily, but you should just, you should just pay attention to exiting as quickly as possible and having your conversation outside. So that is something to think about. So, and then it has one more paragraph here. Let's see, two more paragraphs then. Among the laws of the precepts. So how do you actually do this? It's not a mitzvah tamidi. It's a mitzvah that has to do with when you're in the place. So among that is that you should walk backwards little by little when you're leaving the service of the temple. And the members of the watch, also meaning, which we're going to look at shortly, the Levites and the Kohanim who are standing guard, will also exit the sanctuary backwards. And then also it's forbidden. It's interesting that he even has to say this. You'd think this is certainly a Kal Vachomer. Oh, no.
Yeah, you'd think.
But this is not inside. This is outside. It's forbidden for a man to relieve himself or to sleep in a position between east and west because the Heichal was at the west. So you can't point. If you're a man peeing outside or in a latrine, whatever, the latrine has to be positioned not towards the west. You should not be. We faced prayer towards the Heichal, which in Yerushalayim was the west, right? Or wherever you're facing, it shouldn't be. You shouldn't be peeing in that direction.
So are you saying none of our toilets should be facing?
So I don't think in America it probably counts. But
maybe that's the basis of feng shui.
Right, but it is saying east-west, and you're not supposed to sleep east-west. Right, between east and west. So that's interesting. And it's and this is interesting, too.
So that would
too.
Be the whole thing. So the only way you could do it is to the south.
South and
north.
Well, you could do south and north. Yeah.
Well, between east and west would encompass
Oh, I don't
north.
Think it means between that way. I think it means between this way. I don't think it means the scope.
Is the bathroom at the hotel and the toilets are east and west?
I don't know. I'm just telling you what the Sefer HaChinuch says. I'm not the architect of the
yeah, you're right,
stuff in the area.
Yeah, I never thought about that.
Could be the men's stalls, because it's talking about men, because
yeah,
they are directional.
Men, so women,
women are up and down. All right. So anyway. right. Let's see, what was this last thing here? I see it.
Build a porch in the
middle. Right, right, thank you, that's what I meant to say. You're not allowed to build a building that looks like it either or incorporated into your house. So let's say you're a wealthy person, you're building a palace on Ocean Parkway, and you want your front porch to look like the ulam.
Not
permitted, right? You can't build a building that's not the sanctuary that looks like the sanctuary, because it's not awe-inspiring. You can't just sit and have breakfast on an ulam-shaped front porch. That's not okay. So you can't do that. And the precept is in effect for men and women everywhere, whether the sanctuary is there or not. We still are duty-bound to venerate it. And you're not even, and this includes not even going, so now this is the prohibition of going on the Temple Mount,
yeah.
You're not even allowed to go in a place where the sanctuary stood, and certainly not into the Kadosh Kadoshim. So anybody who wanted to see the inside of the Dome of the Rock, you'll have to look on the internet, there are pictures, but you can't go there yourself.
You've already been there.
So now the lucky thing is, you know, and you can do tshuva for that.
There
and say, God,
go.
If I would have known, I wouldn't have gone. I'm sorry, and next time I'll be more careful. Right. Right. So, right, if a person violated and acted irreverently in any of these ways, he would thus disobey this positive precept. So there's not a specific punishment for this. You're not going to get lashes. Well, so yes and no, because there's not a punishment for forgetting your husband's birthday either. But there is. That's the punishment of this.
Gotcha.
Right? Is that breach in relationship. And that's why you'd want to do tshuva. The same way you're going to apologize to your husband sincerely and say, gosh, I feel really bad that I did that. I totally, totally spaced it. That's what you say to Hashem. I feel bad that I did it. I didn't know. I didn't know that was the wrong thing to do. And I apologize. Now that I know, I'll be more careful in the future. So you don't have to, like, you know, beat yourself up about it. You just have to talk to Hashem and say, you know, I made a mistake, and I'm sorry.
I only did it once.
Yeah, right, me too.
I've also heard something, though, that all those averas become a mitzvah.
Yeah, once you do tshuva.
Tshuva for it, if it's a you know, stepping stone for your growth, and you
right.
are sorry for it,
right.
it becomes a mitzvah.
There was a short time
that
where
is
you
true.
Could do it.
It wasn't
now,
very
anyway.
Long.
Right, yeah. Those, yeah. Yeah, it's not really an available spot for us these days, unfortunately. Well, it's unfortunate that the Muslims are in charge and that we are so ridiculous to give up control to people who shouldn't be in control of the spot. Mm-hmm. So, not that we're getting political at all. okay, now let's look at 388 and 391.
Oh, we're not going to do 40 and 40.
Yeah, we will.
Okay.
But
wait a minute. Back.
Can't we do that yet? Yeah, we'll look at 388. We're pretty much going to be looking at 388.
You brought four.
Good. Yeah. Excellent.
I have them in the car, too. I guess 388. I put them all in the car. That's what I did. I put all mine in the car, and I didn't bring them in.
Smart. She just brings them all.
Yeah.
Like the rest of us.
She is, because she's a woman. She's working out. She's bringing her books. Right. Okay, 388. The Kohanim and the Levites were commanded to guard the sanctuary. So this commandment is the precept of guarding the sanctuary. Who has that mitzvah? The Kohanim and the Levites, the ones who are supposed to guard it. So there's a specific watch that's set up. So the first principle is it must be guarded continually. And the guarding is by walking about it continually. Every single night, the entire night. Thus, watching being in order to honor, exalt, and distinguish it. It's not a guard because you're afraid somebody's going to come in. It's guarding like the guards at Buckingham Palace, right? Those guards and those big, you know, what are those called? The beefeater hats, right? And the whole outfit. They're not protecting anything. They're not there to grab you. They're there for decorum. Somebody else is there to grab you, right? They are there for decorum. They're there to add an air of awe and reverence to the palace. That's what this guard is for. This guard is for awe and reverence to the palace, right? So this is God's palace, and there must be guards to add that air of awe and reverence. That's why we looked at the other mitzvah first, the mitzvah of awe and reverence for the sanctuary. So one way that you do that is by this mitzvah, the mitzvah of guarding the sanctuary.
And this one is reserved to specific.
And this
people
is specifically
as opposed to
for
all of us.
Right. This is the Kohanim. Right. So the way in which we would participate in this, I mean, this does only apply to male Kohanim and Levi'im at the time that the temple exists. They're the only ones who have to do this mitzvah. However, we Israelites make it possible for that to happen because we feed them, right? And we tithe our produce and our money in order to sustain them so that they can do this mitzvah. Otherwise, they'd have to, you know, work in a different way. This is work, but we pay them for this work, right? So that's the mitzvah. So they have to now divide. The way it works is they divide the night up into three different watches. And that is Sha'ot Zmaniot, right? So it has to do with there's an hour that's a 60-minute hour, and then there's an hour that's a 1/24th of the day. Really, it's 1/12th of the light hours or 1/12th of the dark hours. It's not. If it was 1/24th of the day, it would be 60 minutes, right? So a 1/24th of a day is 60 minutes. A 1/12th of sunrise to sunset is a Sha'az Zmanit. That's what it's called, a time hour. And Sha'az Manit changes with the season. Depends on how long the day is and how long the night is. It could be a 50-minute hour. It could be a 90-minute hour, depending on where you are, right? So the watches are divided into three of the nighttime hours, and the Kohanim have different things about that. And that's why you'll see different things in the Gemara refer to until the end of the first watch or the third watch or the second watch, right? So I think that you're not positive, but I think you're allowed to say Kriyat Shema until the end of the third watch, but it's preferable you say by the end of the first watch. So meaning you can say the nighttime Shema any time during the night, but better you should say it in the beginning of the night and then the end of the night. But as long as it's still dark, you can still say the nighttime Shema. So you could technically today say it at 5:30 in the morning. Right? It's nice and dark outside. You could still say it. But you're really supposed to say it before the end of the first watch. That's the preferable time. So those watches are used to delineate time as well as what's going on here. So that's what really the mitzvah is that they divide it up, and there's different ways of doing it. Now, here's a scary thing. You're not allowed to fall asleep, right? So there's extra laws for it. So what can happen if you fall asleep? Poor guys here. It's pretty mean, yeah. So you're walking around, and if you see a sentry that fails to stand and greet you and say, "Man of the Temple Mount, peace abide with you," then it's obvious that he was sleeping on the job, so you can strike him with your staff. And if he doesn't jump up, you can set fire to his cloak until you hear him hopping around and shouting, and people will say, "What is that sound in the temple court?" And somebody will answer, "It's the sound of a Levite being beaten and his clothing being burned because he slept at his watch."
Wow. Talk about public humiliation.
Right.
I guess they didn't do it that often then.
Right, I think they did not. Yeah, I think that was the purpose of this, is that...
Take it seriously.
Right, take it seriously. And I bet it was difficult to stay awake. I know one of my jobs in the Army was called Ritzat Laila. It was a girl job. The boys guarded, and that was actually guarding, right, to be Shomer. And the girls' job was Ritzat Laila. So the Ritzat Laila was to keep the boys awake on their posts. Right? You went from post to post. You brought them snacks and drinks and chatted with them. 15 minutes here, 15 minutes there. Do you need anything? You know, and you just made the circuit to keep the boys awake on the job. That was a girl's
job.
Right? Read that, Lila. Right, so depending on who was on watch, you had to know who was whose girlfriend and to decide who's going to be the Read that, Lila that night. Might take away from the guarding a little, you never know. depending on what. Anyway, so it was hard to stay awake, but that was something they had to work on, and there's all kinds of details of the law. What if they do fall asleep? What if they have a nocturnal emission, which means that they would be tamei and then wouldn't be able to serve as the guard? So then what do you do if that happens? So I guess that would probably mean what if they fall asleep and that happens. So then they both fell asleep and that happened. So then now what? Now they're on the watch in their tummy and they can't be on the watch. So what do you do?
Text another
right, right. So I think, you know, now we would just be texting. Right.
Whoops.
Right. Right. So anyway, all those laws can be found in Tractate Midot, and it applies to the Kohanim. So to have that watch, that's a positive commandment. And then
Kohanim and Levites,
right? For the Kohanim and the Levites, yeah. Right. The opposite side of that is Mitzvah 391, not to put an end to the guarding of the sanctuary. So it's a positive commandment to guard it, and it's a negative commandment to not interrupt that guard. It has to keep going. That's something that has to happen every night, and you're not allowed to make it go away. So this is one of those things where there's a, and the discussion here is really how do you derive that from the grammar of the Pasuk. But so we have the positive, do it, and we have the negative, don't stop it. So there's that. I want to get to the extra credit, but we're not going to do the whole thing, so I just want to know who did the extra credit work. Mom. Hooray, you get a gold star! We will look at it next week. I'm going to hand out photocopies.
I won't be here next week.
Oh, no!
She doesn't have
a gold star.
I'll do it really fast.
Okay, you, everybody take one of these who doesn't have their book. I'm going to keep this one, okay? And, yeah, you tell us what you found.
Okay. What was the assignment?
Okay, the assignment was to find the place in Derech Hashem that talks about the sections of the Mikdash as they relate to the sections of prayer and the Tetragrammaton, the four-letter name of God. Find that place. So on your sheets, I put one reference, and I photocopied that. But we're going to have Marlon report, and then we'll look at it more in depth another time, okay. Whether it's next week or not.
Okay. So there were four areas of the Holy Temple, the Hechal, the Ulam, the Azara, and the Mikdash. And then on page 301 in Derech Hashem, which
in your volume.
But you have to reference this way. So see how I referenced it?
Oh.
You have to reference. That's the standard. See, look at the bottom of the page.
4, 6, 11.
Right. There's a section.
Oh, yeah.
There's a chapter in the section, and there's a section of that chapter.
Okay. So
that's
section,
how you.
Okay. So the
so
section
it's four.
Is,
four.
The section is four, serving God.
Chapter
four,
six, right?
Point six to.
So that's a chapter six, and then the paragraphs in the chapter?
Paragraph 10.
Paragraph 10, okay.
Okay, so the four elements of the Mikdash, the sanctuary, refer to, really nicely, to the four general sections of the service, which is, the first is the Korbanot, which is the sacrificial system. The second is the Pesukei Dezimra, which consists of psalms and other biblical praises. The third is the Shema and its blessings, and the fourth is the Amidah and the concluding prayers. So those are the four basic, those are our services, and that's the four parts of the temple. And then the also you're asking about the Tetragrammaton, and that is shown in, again, chapter 4, number 11, page 303. It's the name of God is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Four letters, and again, the letter four. I mean,
the number four, but yeah, it applies to each one of those levels going up.
Exactly, and it says, in order for all creation to be perfected, these three letters must be brought together, and their interconnection is alluded to by the final hey. So, this is, it's getting really,
this is getting super Kabbalistic, right?
Yeah.
Right. So.
So I mean, to just simplify it, it's again the number four, and then there was another four in here also. It talks about the patriarchs, the three patriarchs,
and David,
Isaac, Abraham, and Jacob, and it's completed by the merit of King David, who represents the final four.
Right. So it's a four.
Lots of four.
The four wheels of the chariot, right? And King David is the fourth, right? And then the four worlds through which things become manifest.
Right. Mm. Asiya, Bria. I mean, there's just lots of fours. But this whole thing was so Kabbalistic, and so without getting into it. But basically, everything is fours. Everything is layer on top of layers, levels, and so it just it's one more level that shows God's hand in everything.
Right. It's the coolest. So that's why I just copied this one page. because it is, this does get like far, and we don't have time to go as in depth with this as it might be interesting to go. But we're going to take the method of, everybody has the source now. So Hamevin Yavin, you can look it up on your own and get what you can get out of it. So from before and after this page, but at least this page, and I copied this because it has some commentary also. From my
oh, this isn't the same as
yours. No, it's a different book.
Oh,
correct.
Okay. The, I have a different book too.
The Hebrew and the translation is the same. It's the R.A. Kaplan translation.
Oh, okay.
But the book that I have is the Pathways, which has the English commentary also.
I think I have
so
that.
You don't have that. Right.
Gotcha.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
You
right.
actually may have both.
You may have both. Because we did.
I don't think so. I think
this was out of print, so we were trying to get this.
You used this one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I think
well,
I
don't have
yeah,
commentary.
You may have. Yeah. Yeah, we did try to get this for everybody.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll rejoin next week to learn more.
I'll be in.